Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And it's a real blessing to have David Seeloff with us. As most of you know, David is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. You can go to the website at askelm.com. ELM stands for Ernest L. Martin. You can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And we are working on our new series here, Star of Bethlehem, the Star that Astonished the World. And this is chapter 2 that we will begin tonight. And that chapter is, Who Were the Wise Men? And I think a lot of you are going to be shocked when you find out the truth about this. So get your notepad and your pen, because you're going to want to make notes. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. This is chapter 2, Who Were the Wise Men, of Dr. Martin's book, The Star That Astonished the World. It's available online, and you can follow along while we read it, as well as following along in your Bible. And, of course, the book is available for purchase, too. And so let's just get right into it. One of the most important points in understanding what the New Testament states about the Star of Bethlehem is to realize the social and political status of the wise men who came to Herod, King Herod. The word that was used to describe them was magi. This was a title in the first century, and it signified that they were professional astrologers. But astrology in those days was completely different than what it the silly stuff that it is today.
Yeah, it wasn't about fortune telling.
Right. This fact is so well known in scholarly circles that many modern translators of the New Testament simply render magi as astrologers without explanation. And once this primary point is realized, we are provided with reliable information that can make the account of the magi's visit to Herod understandable. The simple teaching of the Gospel of Matthew states that astrologers came from the eastern part of the world to pay homage to the newborn King of the Jews and to present him with the customary gifts that were generally accorded to new kings. The account in the New Testament does not mean that the writer of the Gospel of Matthew was endorsing the principles of astrology, because there are biblical verses condemning its religious practice,
yes,
which Matthew would no doubt was aware of. But in mentioning their trek to Jerusalem, Matthew shows that the Magi themselves were motivated by symbolic principles, which were taken seriously by people in the world at the time. The recording of this account in Matthew makes it clear that Matthew did not view these magi as quacks or charlatans. When the magi came to Jerusalem with their announcement that the star of the newborn king had been seen, Herod was, quote, was troubled and all Jerusalem with him, end quote. Since the magi were professional astrologers as well as astronomers, as well as astrologers, the mention of their visit to Jerusalem was Matthew's way of securing the testimony of top scientific authorities to authenticate the royal birth of Jesus. And now we're going to consider the importance of the Magi. These Magi came from the east bearing rich gifts for the newborn king. They could not have been reckoned as certain classes of astrologers, of sorcerers, and confidence men who roamed the Roman world under the name Magi. Herod and all Jerusalem would hardly have been troubled by what they considered impostors. But if the Magi had come from the court of the Parthian kings, who employed magi in the religious affairs of their government, or from the respected Magian colleges of the East, then that would have been a different matter in the view of Herod and the religious authorities in Jerusalem. In order to have an audience with Herod, and for him to have members of the Sanhedrin, which was the supreme court of the Jews, to hear the interpretations of these magi, that alone must show that they were held in high esteem by the people of Jerusalem. In their deportment, it was customary for the magi to dress in magnificent priestly attire to indicate their professional status. In presenting themselves before royalty, the royal records, the historical records, show that the Magi did this with pomp and circumstance. In traveling or on official business, in areas where their influence was felt, it was normal for the priestly Magi to proceed in a processional mode with various ranks of them appropriately positioned within the caravan. This must have been the manner in which they approached the city of Jerusalem to present their gifts to the newborn king of the Jews. And this would account for this respectful attitude of Herod and the Jewish authorities to them.
Wasn't the Christ child, he wasn't just newborn when the Magi showed up? He was a year or so old?
Well, actually, older than that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, at least a year old. So we'll get into that in later chapters for sure.
Okay.
And the footnotes for all these chapters are indicated on the internet and also in the book. But in traveling, well, let's see here. Where am I here? Now, this would account for the respectful attitude of Herod and the Jewish authorities to them. The way they presented themselves identified them to Herod and the Jewish authorities. It's important to realize that this type of travel for respected Magian priests is not a fantasy story. They traveled in majestic style. The account recorded by Matthew fits well with other journeys of Magian priests when they were presented to kings or emperors. When Tiridates of the Order of the Magi was made king over Armenia by the Emperor Nero, the Roman Emperor Nero, the new Magian king went to Rome with other Magi to present gifts to Emperor Nero. A great deal of ceremony was associated with this visit of the Magi. This must have been the case with the Magi who came to King Herod. He would have given them a proper ceremonial protocol. This is why, quote, all Jerusalem, end quote, knew of their coming and why members of the Sanhedrin were summoned to hear their interpretations on the star that they had seen. The account in Matthew harmonizes perfectly with other historical events involving Magi in the time of the Roman Empire. Now, the professional role of the Magi. There is a considerable amount of early information about the Magi of the East. We are told by the ancient historian, the Greek historian Herodotus, that the Magi were originally one of the six tribes of the Medes, a priestly caste, similar to the Levites among the Israelites. Now, in their early history, their occupation was to provide the kings of the Medes, Persians and Babylonians, with what they considered to be divine information about the daily matters involving governmental affairs. Because of the high religious and political esteem accorded to them by the peoples of the East, they were able in the 6th century BCE even to overturn some of the royal powers. Their role in interpreting divine matters for kings and rulers is mentioned in the Bible. The prophet Daniel, in the time of King Nebuchadnezzar, became the, quote, master of the magicians, or the master of the magi, master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, end quote. the prophet Jeremiah mentioned that a chief authority among the Magi at in his time was called the Rabmag, Rabmag, or R-A-B-M-A-G. Now, the prophet Daniel must have been assigned to this high office, and perhaps the fraternization of Daniel with these early Magi in Babylon helps explain why those in the Magian profession expected a Jewish king to arrive near the end of the first century. This is the very thing that Daniel prophesied would happen. Recall that Daniel prophesied the rebuilding of Jerusalem after the Babylonians destroyed it in the 6th century BC. He also said that 490 years would pass from a command to rebuild Jerusalem until a world-embracing messianic kingdom would emerge on the earth in the region of Palestine. The prophecy had numerous unknown factors associated with it. For example, Daniel did not clearly explain which command to rebuild Jerusalem was meant. He did not say whether his year lengths were solar or lunar. Regarding the Messiah, Daniel did not indicate if the 490 years would end with his birth, his bar mitzvah, when he would become 20 years of age, or when he would be old enough to be able to go to war, or when he would become 30, which was the year of spiritual adulthood, or whenever the Messiah would be proclaimed king, which could happen at any time during his life. Well, because Daniel did not detail these points, the prophecy was vague to the Jews and others at the time. It was subject to a variety of interpretations. Most Jews, however, were certain enough about the prophecy to believe that it would occur sometime in the first century. Josephus, the Jewish historian, who lived in the last part of the first century, mentioned a conviction among the Jews that this prophecy of Daniel would have its fulfillment within the first century. Josephus said that it was shown in the, quote, sacred writings that the sacred writings that about that time one from their country, meaning Judea, would become governor of the habitable earth. And this is in Josephus' Wars of the Jews. So there can be no doubt that the Magi in Mesopotamia would have been aware of these prophetic indications among the Jews. In fact, scholars today are able to see that there was a great deal of mingling of beliefs between the Jews and the Magi at this period of time. This was because of their connections with one another since the 6th century BCE. Remember, a lot of the Jews did not come back from Babylon. A great number of them, almost the majority, stayed in Babylon once they had the opportunity to return back to Judea. That's a small aside. Even the Romans were aware of the prophecies of Daniel. The Roman historian Suetonius in the early 2nd century said, quote, a firm belief had long prevailed throughout the East that it was destined for the empire of the world at that time to be given to someone who should go forth from Judea. End quote. The Roman historian Tacitus also said, quote, the majority of the Jewish people were very impressed with the belief that it was contained in ancient writings of the priests, that it would come to pass that at that very time the East would renew its strength and they should go forth from Judea, should be rulers of the world. End quote. Even the Roman Emperor Nero was advised by one or two of his court astrologers that it was prudent for him to move his seat of empire to Jerusalem because that city was destined to be the capital of the world. All of these widespread beliefs were based on the prophecies of Daniel. And since Jewish people lived in all areas of the Roman and Parthian worlds, their national aspirations would have been well known. Especially, as an aside, especially anything dealing with a king would have been closely monitored by the Roman authorities.
Oh, yes.
even back to the text, even among the Magi themselves, there were the traditional teachings of Zoroaster who influenced Magian doctrine in the time of Herod. Zoroaster, an early religious leader and teacher in the region where the Magi had their origin, taught that at some time in the future, there would arrive a king who would raise the dead and transform the world into a kingdom of peace and security. Interestingly, Zoroastrian traditions associated with the prophesied king said that this king would come forth from the stock of Abraham. Now, these beliefs among the peoples of Nearer Asia and in the Roman Empire are a simple fact of history. Whether people wish to believe them is another matter. The job of the historian is not to give judgments on the validity or non-validity of these early prophetic or traditional teachings of the Jews, Romans, or the Magi. Historians should simply state what the ancient peoples believed, and that is what Dr. Martin says he's trying to do in this book. But one thing for certain, it's not possible to comprehend the history of the first century unless people today are aware of these beliefs that motivated the social, religious, and political actions of those early peoples. All nations were then affected in a profound way by astrological and prophetic teachings. This is a simple historical fact, and most scholars today accept this without argument. These early prophetic convictions of the Jews, Romans, and the Magi were important to those people who lived in the first century. And the use of astrological interpretations in evaluating the historical events of the time was at an all-time high during this period. So when the Magi, who were professional astrologers, saw what they considered to be the star of a Jewish king, it was a certain sign to them to go to Jerusalem with gifts to present to that newborn king. Now, we're going to discuss the Jews and the Magi.
Okay.
Most Jews admired the Magi of the East. This was not only because of their former association with the prophet Daniel, but also because they were not idolaters. Though the Magi believed that the power of the deity was manifested in the natural elements of fire, air, water, and earth, these Gentile priests did not set up material images in in recognition of God. They did not make up any or set up any material images. They were, in one way of looking at it, Gentiles who were leaning toward monotheistic belief. Jews in the first century respected the Magi. The Jewish philosopher by the name of Philo, who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, during the time of Jesus, spoke of the Magi with warm praise. Philo said they were men who gave themselves to the study of the laws of nature, and that they contemplated on the divine perfections. To Philo, they were worthy of being counselors of kings. The main occupation of the Magi was their interpretation of things they considered to be divine. They dealt principally with the evaluation of dreams and visions and astronomical signs. Astrological interpretation was of special importance to them. The Temple of Belus, in what remained of the city of Babylon, that temple was in their care. In particular, they were advisors to kings and princes, and they were especially consulted regarding the destinies of kings. The Parthian kings of the East had them as their advisors, and they were the ones who performed the ceremonies at their coronations. The Roman authors Cicero and Plutarch inform us that the Magi were the ones who instructed kings and princes in the East. They handled the education, in other words, of the princes. Except in rare circumstances, only royalty were allowed to be initiated into their secret teachings and understandings. This is one reason why the Magi must have felt it proper to inform Herod, King Herod, that, about the details of their interpretation concerning the star that they had been following. And though Herod would have had his own court astrologers, he must have paid particular attention to what the respected Magian professionals from the East had to say about a newborn Jewish king. Their interpretations were especially sought out by prominent people because of the Magian influence in the royal courts of the East. In fact, the Magi were in such high regard in Parthia that they themselves even became kings. Even the Magi who came to Jesus were also considered as being princes or kings in some early accounts. Perhaps they were royalty themselves. But when, for example, all of Jesus' brothers that were born after, you know, to Mary and Joseph, they were all actually of royal blood.
Yes.
So likewise, the Magi may themselves have been princes. But when the Magi came to Jerusalem, they arrived to do homage to the new Jewish king and to give gifts to him. In the next century after this, Tiridates of the Order of the Magi did the same thing when he visited the Emperor Nero. So it's no wonder that the arrival of such Magi caused great interest to Herod and to those in Jerusalem. Now let's look at the gifts of the Magi. It's interesting that the treasures brought by the Magi, which were gold, frankincense, and myrrh, were the major gifts mentioned in the Greek translation of Isaiah 60, verse 6, that foreign kings would one day bring to Israel's messianic ruler. It's not in the Hebrew text, but in the Greek translation. The tradition that there were only three Magi stems from the assumption that each of them gave one gift to Jesus.
That's quite an assumption.
Yeah, it is. And actually, nobody knows how many Magi there were who went to Jerusalem, but some traditions mention as many as 12. And we have no way of knowing their exact number or how many people were in their entourage. You know, some caravans had 50 or 100 people, actually. And they may have joined other caravans also for safety. Because after all, they did have gold and they probably had guards and everything else with them. At any rate, these respected Magi came to Jerusalem bearing gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which were the customary gifts of subject nations to their superiors. The Magi, in this case, came to do obeisance and to offer fealty to a new Jewish king. They must have realized that something more than an ordinary royal birth was awaiting them. They no doubt had in mind the prophetic beliefs among the Jews, Romans, and others that a world ruler was then destined to come from the race of Abraham in the area of Palestine. We're told in the New Testament that the main factor that brought the Magi to Jerusalem was, quote, his star, end quote. But what star or heavenly body could this have been? And though there was an interesting conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in 7 BC, with Mars forming a triangular aspect with those planets in early 6 BC, the planets at that time were at least two diameters of the moon away from each other, and they could not in any way be considered as a single star. As for the years 5 and 4 BC, there was nothing of astronomical importance that would have impressed anyone to journey to Jerusalem. But in 3 and 2 BC, as we covered last time in chapter 1, the whole heavens burst forth with astronomical signs and wondrous displays. It may well be that the celestial occurrences in this latter period of time were the very ones that prompted the Magi to go to Jerusalem. And since they were astrologers, we should look in the contemporary historical records of this period for astronomical events that could be interpreted and understood within an astrological context. Now let's notice what the New Testament relates on this matter. we'll deal with the Magi and King Herod. In explaining to King Herod why they came to do homage to the new Jewish king, the Magi said, quote, "We saw his star at its rising, or when it rose," end quote. The King James Version of the New Testament suggests that the Magi simply saw his star in the east. But this rendering does not signify or represent what the Greek signifies. It was not merely in the east that the Magi observed the star. The Gospel of Matthew says they saw it, quote, "at its rising," end quote. The New English Bible gives the proper translation, quote, "we observed the rising of his star." Scholars realize that the Greek words employed by Matthew to record this event were the ordinary ones then used in Greek literature to describe the regular rising of the stars or the planets. The plain meaning of the words suggest that the Magi had witnessed a star rise above the eastern horizon when they made their normal pre-dawn observations of the heavens. And later, much later, a year or so, more than a year, when the Magi got to Jerusalem, they told King Herod about the rising of that star. Herod and all Jerusalem were inquisitive and asked, as Vincent renders the account, quote, "How long does the star make itself visible? How long does the star make itself visible since its rising in the east?" End quote. The language of Matthew shows it was an ordinary type of star that rose in the east just like normal stars, not a comet or anything like that. So there's the Magi saw an actual celestial object, an actual star. There's no doubt that the New Testament is using normal astronomical terms to describe these events. The narrative clearly shows that the Magi observed an ordinary star or planet ascending above the eastern horizon, which they interpreted as the sign that a Jewish king was now within his nativity period. It was one star that intrigued them, though it must have been in some unusual relationship or aspect with other celestial bodies. The Magi were so impressed that they made their long, difficult journey to Jerusalem with costly gifts to present to the new king. After hearing their account, King Herod and all Jerusalem were equally persuaded that the star was significant. Now remember, this period of time was one when astrological interpretations made by first-class professionals were looked on as valid scientific indications of impending events. So confident was the Roman government about such matters that some 60 years before, the Roman Senate ordered that all baby boys must not be allowed to live in 63 BC, when astrological and prodigious forecasts had determined that a, quote, "king of the Romans," end quote, was to be born. This earlier event would have been well known to Herod and to people throughout the Roman Empire. To secure its supposed validity in the opinion of the people at the time, Augustus Caesar was indeed born in that very year. Herod must have felt a great deal of uneasiness when similar prognostications were being made by the Magi about a king of the Jews who had just been born in King Herod's realm. Now, the world at that time believed in astrological signs. Herod would have been aware of the outstanding celestial events that occurred from May, the month of May in 3 BC, all the way continuing through to August of 2 BC. His own court astrologers would certainly have given him their interpretations of these remarkable signs, but Herod wanted more information. And since the various nations and racial groups had different standards for astrological interpretations, Herod would have wanted to know the Magian version, the version of the Magi, of what the signs were indicating. Some astrologers were reckoned as being better than others. Among the best in the world, as viewed by people in the first century, were the professional Chaldeans and the Magi of the East. And Herod wanted to know what their interpretations were regarding the remarkable heavenly drama that occurred in 3 and 2 BC. The Magi left him in no doubt about their interpretations. They were so certain of their evaluations that they made a long journey to Jerusalem to give rich gifts to the newborn king. So important was this child to them that they even came as well themselves to give him homage. This meant that they recognized the newborn as a personage of special significance. This is what Matthew in the New Testament related.
And in those days, Herod would have been well aware of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And indeed, like the Romans 60 years before, Herod was so convinced of the interpretations of the Magi that he killed all the boy babies in and around Bethlehem to prevent this newborn king from being reared to adulthood. Herod was astonished by the appearance of this star, and he was persuaded that the star of the Magi was very significant and important. Now, what was this star that caused the Magi, Herod, and the world to be astounded? Well, the answer to this query can now be known, and we will understand it clearly as we continue in this book. And so ends chapter 2. Who were the Magi?
Wow. You know, it's just amazing how God works. I mean, here's this guy. He goes around, orders all these babies slaughtered. Oh, my gosh, David. You know, I can just imagine the mothers and the fathers.
Right.
How they, you know. But you know, here we are a couple of thousand years later, and people, they don't wise up. I don't understand why.
People abort babies because it's inconvenient.
Yeah. Duh, boy. Keep the pants zipped and the skirts down, there'd be a lot less heartaches. Oh, gosh. Well, do you want to go ahead with part 3?
Yeah.
Roll.
We can do chapter 3, yeah.
Okay.
Now, okay, chapter 3 is titled, Was the Star a Real Star? Well, the language that Matthew employed to describe the Star of the Magi strongly suggests that it was an ordinary star or planet. After all, the Magi themselves were astrologers and interested in the motions of the heavenly bodies. Since most people profoundly respected the practice of astrology in the time of Augustus and King Herod, it has convinced many scholars that the Magi were observing a real star. And this is surely what the New Testament is stating. Probably no other star in history has been more sought after than the star of the Magi. What star could it have been? The ingenious Kepler in the early 17th century suggested that it may have been a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn appearing near some other star. In the last century, Edeler, Edeler, found that 3 conjunctions of Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of Pisces occurred in the year 7 BC, and there was Mars coming into their vicinity in early 6 BC that gave a triangular positioning of the planets to one another. It was also found that a Jewish rabbi named Abarbanel, commenting on the book of Daniel, and he said this in about the 1400s, 1437 to 1508 was when he lived, said that a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn within Pisces had messianic meaning. Several scholars in the last century felt that the occurrences of 7-6 BC were probably the ones that inspired the Magi to go to Jerusalem. The reason Idler picked this year is as the likely candidate is because it was beginning to be thought among historians that Jesus could not have been born after 4 BC. Though some of the prime historical sources were chronologically contradictory for the period, historians were already beginning to dogmatize that Jesus had to have been born at least 4 years, or better yet, 5 or 6 years, before the beginning of our common era. This is why Idler concentrated on astronomical signs before 4 BC. There is, however, a major difficulty with this earlier year of 7-6 BC. It's very early for the birth of Jesus. It is almost too early if one relies on the simple New Testament chronological statements as a guide. Accepting this earlier period also casts aside virtually all the testimony of the earlier scholars and historians of the Christian Church who said dogmatically that Jesus was born in the period of 3 to 1 BC. The period, the birth of Jesus was after 4 BC, which means it was either 3 BC or 2 BC or 1 BC. After 4 BC, you count down. This period of 3 to 1 BC for the dating of Jesus' birth, for the early Christian historians, however, should not be jettisoned from our thinking. It's unfair and non-professional to dismiss as unworthy of consideration the vast number of these early Christian scholars who testified that Jesus was born in the period we recognize as 3 to 1 BC. And properly, modern scholars are now beginning to recognize that the early Christian scholars had far more ancient records to consult than we do today. They were able to examine the volumes in the famous Alexandrian Library, reportedly to have had up to 700,000 volumes. There was a library at Pergamos in Greece, or in Turkey, with over 200,000 volumes. And the library at Caesarea on the Palestinian coast, with its great numbers of historical documents, was also extant and available to many of these scholars. To show the extent of these libraries of historical records of important individuals, we have from a reliable source that the Alexandrian Library had in their catalog of scrolls 2 million lines, at 50 lines a page, which would equal 40,000 of our pages, had 2 million lines on the life of Zoroaster alone. Zoroaster was the early teacher of the Magi, as Moses was the early teacher to the Jews. This shows that an abundance of material was available for Greek-speaking peoples to read about the doctrines of Zoroaster. If the records of Zoroaster's life were found in the Alexandrian Library in such quantity, what about the accounts of other individuals who were important in the Roman Empire? There must have been vast numbers of other historical works that would have described events in Palestine and Rome within those early libraries. But this does not end the matter. Besides those libraries in the East, there were official records at Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire itself. The records were kept at the capital like those in our Library of Congress. Those records would have been available to Christian scholars, especially after the time of Constantine the Great, who made practice of the Christian religion the official religion of Rome. And besides government record keeping, there were at least 26 other libraries in Rome that were associated with certain institutions at the capital whose scrolls could also have been examined by early Christian scholars. So there can be no doubt that those scholars had access to much of this literary evidence to study and to evaluate in making their historical judgments. But what do we have left of them, of those documents? Only rags and tatters have come down to us. Actually, early Christian historians had many historical sources not known to us today. Let's be plain about these early historical records, which concern the time period of Christ's birth. There is not a single Christian scholar who was able to do research at any of the above libraries who has stated that 7, 6, or even 5 BC was the time for Christ's birth. Every one of them is at odds with modern historical opinion on this particular subject. Most of the early scholars focused on the year from 3 to 2 BC, and Dionysius Aegeus in the 6th century finally accepted a late date of 1 BC for Jesus' birth. It's truly a disservice of the highest rank that no serious attention is being given to the historical beliefs of these early scholars. Their historical evaluations, given when Rome and the Empire had functioning libraries during the period of Pax Romana, have been dismissed out of hand and without the slightest consideration by many modern scholars. This is not only unfair, it's just absurd. And Dr. Martin says, "Forgive me for being blunt, but it's time to demand reversal of this situation. It's not that I want my opinion to prevail at the expense of all other historical evaluations, but it's only reasonable that all ancient authorities be given a fair hearing in this important chronological and historical matter." And actually, modern theologians are rather apathetic about the whole thing. But, you know, let's look at the state of affairs today. So engraven in stone is the opinion that one has to look before 4 BC for the birth of Jesus and the celestial events that brought the Magi to Jerusalem, that few theologians have felt it necessary to convene a forum of competent scholars even to discuss the issue. The present opinions are considered by many church leaders, well, simply to be infallible. And why are some theologians so adamant today in advocating a period before 4 BC? It is because of a single section of an account by the Jewish historian Josephus, which has been misinterpreted and misunderstood concerning the time of King Herod's death. We will discuss this matter in a later chapter and show the simple answer to the problem. The truth is, however, the years 3 to 2 BC have far more historical credentials and spectacular astronomical displays than any immediate period before 4 BC. When we focus on these 2 years of 3 to 2 BC, then the evidence that the Star of the Magi was a real star is just overwhelming. Other years around the beginning of our era pale to insignificance compared to 3 to 2 BC. The description of Matthew about the star does not at all fit what happened in 7 or 6 BC. Jupiter and Saturn in their three conjunctions at that time were at least 2 diameters of the moon away from each other. No one could possibly imagine them as being a single star. As a matter of fact, there was a similar conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces, which occurred 59 years before, and it was an even a closer one. If such a conjunction had messianic overtones to it from an astrological point of view, why did not that occurrence also bring Magi to Jerusalem? Even Aberbanel's astrological interpretation given in the 15th century has problems. Though the rabbi may well have been relating a general belief among the Jews in his own time about the messianic significance of Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces, there is no early literature of the Jews or Gentiles that they would have interpreted that way some 1500 years before. Indeed, there are so many uncertainties of interpretation connected with the astronomical events in 7 to 6 BC that even scholars today, and probably most of them, hold little confidence that any of those celestial phenomena are the ones in which to which Matthew refers, even though they continue to dogmatize that Jesus was born before 4 BC. So what does the Bible mean? Well, these difficulties have prompted scholars to offer other explanations. Some have suggested that the Bible is possibly talking about a comet that cannot now be identified. This proposal is unlikely because comets were always interpreted as being harbingers of evil, not of good omens, as the star of the Magi surely suggested. Others have thought it might be an exploding star or a nova. This theory is completely unprovable, and most scholars reject the idea. After all, how can a comet or a nova lead the Magi to Jerusalem and stand over Bethlehem, as Magi said the star did? Some religious people have wanted to dismiss the account of Matthew as referring to any star in heaven. They believe that Matthew was talking about the actions of an angel. Others say that it was an outright miracle that is impossible to explain by natural laws. Of course, if Matthew were describing the actions of an angel or simply recording the results of a supernatural event, then further astronomical or historical inquiry is rather useless. This is the opinion some religious folk today wish to adopt. Some religious people feel afraid to look at any explanation that might be astronomical, which they often interpret to mean as astrological. They prefer outright miracles to anything that might be considered as natural. But are the supernatural explanations correct? The supernatural interpretations that some propose are simply not necessary. Such evaluations run counter to the simple descriptions given in the Gospel of Matthew. Recall that in Matthew's account, in which he uses words denoting astronomical terms as ordinarily understood by the Greek-speaking people in the first century, he said the Magi saw his star rising in the east. Would the Magi have seen an angel or some miraculous sign rise above the eastern horizon? Well, this belief is hardly suitable. After all, the Magi were themselves astrologers. They were looking for celestial signs involving the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars of heaven, not miraculous events. Had the latter been the case, they simply would have told King Herod that they had seen an angel or a miraculous display in the heavens, and that would have been the end of the matter. There is another problem in evaluating the star as an angel. This belief is not compatible with the narrative of Matthew and Luke, but of course that doesn't stop some people. Let's just ignore the text. Look, we have our own opinion.
Yeah.
It was the custom of Matthew to state when an angel was involved in an event associated with Jesus' activity, such as Matthew 1, verse 20, or when a vision or a dream was given by an angel, such as in Matthew 2, verse 13. The same is the case with Luke. He even named the angel who gave the announcement to Mary. He called him the angel Gabriel. And Luke certainly did not think of Gabriel as a star. Luke recorded that many angels were seen by the shepherds who were minding their flocks near Bethlehem. And again, he did not describe them as being stars. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind that there is an association of stars and angels in Scripture, but that's not what Matthew or Luke are talking about. Only in the highly figurative or prophetic poetic language in the Bible are angels equated with stars. Matthew was not giving this type of narration in his gospel account. The terms he used to describe the star were the ones that the general population used to denote ordinary stars or planets without any reference to supernatural angelic appearances. There's yet another miraculous explanation that has been suggested for the star of the Magi. Some theologians have imagined that the Magi simply observed an appearance of the Shekinah, the glory of God, like that which led Moses and the children of Israel out of Egypt. This was a shining light during darkness and a cloud by day. And yet when the Bible mentions such visible glory, it was seen by all people in sight of it. Had the Magi observed such a miraculous light, biblical examples show that others in their vicinity would also have seen it. Josephus, the Jewish historian, reported such an appearance of light over the temple just before the Passover season in 66 AD, which the people of Jerusalem observed. But there is no example in the Bible or history that the Shekinah was ever seen rising above the eastern horizon like the star of the Magi appeared. Now, granted, some people, for sentimental reasons or to maintain private theological doctrines, wish that the star of Matthew could be an angel or a miraculous light in the sky. They refuse to believe, some people even think it was a UFO. Have you ever heard that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure have.
Hope none of your guests.
No.
Okay. Some people, for sentimental reasons or to maintain private theological doctrines, wish that the star of Matthew could be an angel or a miraculous light in the sky. They refuse to believe that Matthew was referring to an actual star. It's their privilege to believe such things if they wish, but the evidence in the New Testament and history profoundly suggests that the star was a normal heavenly body that astrologers were interpreting as the sign that a new Jewish king had been born. The star was a real star. The Magi were basing their decisions to go to Jerusalem on the motions of the heavenly bodies. After all, that was their primary occupation. They were professional observers and interpreters of heavenly signs involving the sun, the moon, and planets and the stars. This procedure is thoroughly harmonious with the teachings of the Bible about such things. In the first chapter of Genesis, it says that the stellar bodies were designed to provide signs to those on earth. But those signs are about God and what God is doing, not about you and me and, you know, what we're going to be doing next Thursday.
Right.
For the Magi to have seen a star or a planet rise above the eastern horizon in some significant relationship with other stellar bodies, this would have been thoroughly in accord with that statement in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. The Jewish authorities and even King Herod would not have found such interpretations by the Magi as being odd or anti-biblical. Now we're going to consider the Bible and astronomical occurrences. The Bible actually gives much credence to astronomical signs, and King Herod knew this. It records a divine revelation given to the patriarch Joseph, in which the 12 tribes of Israel were compared to the 12 signs of the zodiac. I don't know how to pronounce zodiacal.
That's okay.
12 signs of the zodiac. Joseph dreamed that the sun represented his father, the moon being feminine, his mother, and his 11 brothers were the 11 constellations of the zodiac, Joseph himself being the 12th. Quote, "Behold, I have a dream. I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars did obeisance to me." And this is in, let's see if we can get there. Yeah, Genesis 37, verses 9 and 10. So consistent, methodical, and symbolic were those motions of the heavenly bodies that King David in Psalm 19 equated the celestial bodies with the perfection of the teachings of God. David said that all the stars, all of the stars, planets, moon, and the sun, spoke a language to all people on earth. He said there was, quote, no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line, meaning their rule or their motion, is gone out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. This is Psalm 19, verses 3 and 4. The heavenly bodies contained, or David was saying that these heavenly bodies spoke symbolic teachings to people in the world. Even the Apostle Paul quoted Psalm 19 and said that the heavenly bodies symbolically spoke with their voice or their words, and that their sounds were heard throughout the world. There, meaning the stars, sound went into all the earth, and their words, the words of the stars, unto the ends of the world. This is in Romans 10, verse 18. The heavenly bodies contain much symbolic teaching as far as the first people in the first century were concerned. Also, biblical astronomy had prophetic overtones. The Old Testament contained precedents for this belief. In the book of Job, there are recorded the words of Yahweh himself, the God of the Bible. God said that the star cluster, known as the Pleiades, the seven sisters, influenced things that occurred on earth. And this is in Job 38, verse 31. These seven sisters may be equated with the seven stars of the book of Revelation that denoted the seven angels to the seven churches, seven congregations, seven ecclesias. Recall that such congregations of Christians were even called sisters. This is in 2 John, verse 13. There is much teaching in the Old and New Testaments about the, quote, influences, end quote, of the stellar bodies with affairs occurring on earth. David particularly singled out its sun for its symbolic role in teaching. He called it a bridegroom, like a newly married man with a responsibility for his wife. And who is the bridegroom in the New Testament? It is the Messiah, according to Matthew 25, verses 1 to 10. His coming was prognosticated as being, and will be in the future, as being like the lightning, the sun that comes out of the east. Quote, for as the lightning comes out of the east and shines unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. End quote, Matthew 24, verse 27. The Messiah is thus equated in a symbolic way with the sun. This relationship should not appear strange to biblical readers. The Old Testament itself says that Yahweh was, quote, the Son of Righteousness, S-U-N, Son of Righteousness. This is in Malachi 4, 2. It was common among the early Jews to equate the sun with Yahweh. Not that Yahweh was the Son, but to equate him with Yahweh. And the New Testament writers persisted with the same theme by calling Jesus the bridegroom, or the lightning, which shines out of the east. These astronomical comparisons were made without the slightest condemnation by the prophets and apostles. Let's look at the book of Revelation and astronomical signs. It goes even further than that. In the book of Revelation, we find four living creatures that surround the heavenly throne, just as we do in Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 4 to 28. Scholars recognize that the faces of these creatures, like that of a lion, an eagle, a man, and a bull, denote the four main seasons of the zodiacal year. They are equated with Leo the lion, Scorpio, who is an eagle with its talons, Aquarius, a man bearing water, and Taurus the bull. And this is in Revelation 6, verses 1 to 8, where the four beasts are described as they are in Ezekiel. the tribes of Israel were positioned the same way around the tabernacle when they were traveling in the wilderness and whenever they camped. And this is according to Numbers chapter 2. Leo, representing Judah, the tribe of Judah, was directly east of the entrance to the temple, and it was the beginning sign of the Jewish zodiac. The other three principal tribes were located 90 degrees from each other in a circle going counterclockwise around the sanctuary, forming a zodiacal sign, design. Besides that, in another section of the book of Revelation, the Apostle John saw a sign in heaven of a woman ready to give birth to a man-child who was to rule the earth with a rod of iron. This is in Revelation 12, verses 1 to 5. This woman had the sun clothing her and the moon under her feet. There can be no doubt that this was an astronomical symbol showing the time of Christ's birth. Chapter 5 of this book, we'll get to that, explains this in detail. Okay. Now, when the Apostle John said he saw, quote, a sign in heaven, unquote, the word sign in Greek is the precise word used in ordinary Greek literature to refer to a sign of the zodiac. Jews were interested in astronomical signs. These biblical matters reveal that the New Testament writers commonly identified prophetic events on earth with symbolic comparisons found in the heavenly bodies and their motions. The Jews in general were also doing the same thing in the first century. Note this comment by Professor Charlesworth concerning new discoveries that show this. And this is in James Charlesworth's The Old Testament Pseudepigrapha.
Oh, yeah.
Book 1, page 476.
Yeah.
Quote, Jewish interest in astrology and the zodiac is at least so early as Jesus of Nazareth. This new insight is shown by the early date of the Jewish Sibylline oracles, especially Book 5 and sections 512 to 531, and the discovery among the Dead Sea Scrolls of two Jewish astrological documents, one called 4Q Cryptic, formerly 4Q 186, and the other still unnamed and unpublished. Now, while this is certainly true, Jewish interpretation differed from ordinary Gentile methods in reading the signs. The Jews normally stated that God was in charge of the stellar bodies and that their influences were a manifestation of God's power, his prognostications in order to teach mankind, and not some spiritual manifestations emanating solely from the celestial bodies themselves. Charlesworth gives several examples of this early Jewish mode of interpretation, in the same citation, as a matter of fact. The condemnation of astrology. We must, however, be clear about one fact. The wild interpretations that many astrologers gave about these heavenly motions brought forth the wrath of the prophets in the Old Testament. It was the wrong use of the symbolic teachings, symbolic meanings of that the Bible condemns. The abuse of such things brought forth the anger of the biblical prophets. Quote, you are wearied in the multitude of your counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save you from these things that shall come upon you. This is in Isaiah 47, verse 13.
Right. They were using it for fortune telling and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The prophets were condemning the misuse of the signs that Genesis chapter 1, verse 14 was speaking about. The author of the book of Jubilees, written about 150 B.C., mentioned the same thing. And this is in Jubilee 8, verses 1 to 4. The prophets, however, could not have censured the symbolic teaching associated with the celestial signs themselves. The Bible itself drew attention to the heavenly signs and even forecast future ones. For example, Luke 21, verses 11 and 25. Recall that the Apostle Paul himself said that the voice and the sound of the stars spoke in symbolic language that glorified the role of the Messiah in world affairs. This is in Romans 10, verse 18. The purpose of this book is not to plead for recognition of the symbolic veracity of these various celestial signs. As a book of history, Dr. Martin is only showing what was believed in the world in the first century. He also wishes to show what is contained in the Bible that may have prompted Herod, King Herod, to do what he did. There can be no doubt that King Herod was deeply persuaded by what the Magi from the East told him about the star. Since celestial signs were anticipated for the arrival of the Messianic King who was to rule Israel and the world, King Herod was anxious to find out what the Magi were interpreting about the heavenly signs that all were able to see from 3 to 2 BC. King Herod was well aware of what Moses had prophesied in Numbers 24, verse 17. It was a prophecy involving a future star that was to arise in Israel. Quote, "There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." While King Herod must have had his own court astrologers give him celestial interpretations concerning the biblical prophecies about that important star, he also wanted the opinion of the respected Magi from the East, who were recognized throughout the world as being top professionals in the field. Herod wanted to know their interpretations of what the spectacular stellar signs of 3 to 2 BC really entailed. Since Herod was a king, he was entitled to be initiated into the divine knowledge that the Magi were thought to have.
Even if he wasn't fit.
Right.
Well,
they didn't know that.
Yeah, that just cracks me up, though.
Now, astrological interpretations are not science. It must be remembered that astrological interpretations could differ widely from astrologer to astrologer, certainly today. And the Bible itself shows this. While the early Babylonian astrologers and soothsayers were not able to interpret the visions of Nebuchadnezzar, nor the Egyptian priests the dreams of Pharaoh, the Bible shows that Daniel and Joseph were able to do so. Daniel was even put in charge of the, quote, Magi, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, end quote, in Babylon. This is in Daniel 5, verse 11. Because the Magi who came to King Herod originated in the East, Herod would have been aware of the differences in skills and interpretations of the various astrologers, and he would have wanted to hear the opinions of these professionals from the East. After all, they might have had the correct evaluation from Herod's point of view. In the practical way that Matthew described the whole affair concerning the Magi, it's evident that these Magian priests observed a normal heavenly body ascend above the eastern horizon. It may have been seen in some kind of unusual configuration or relationship with other celestial bodies within the two-year period before they visited Herod. We now know that an 18-month period within the years 3 to 2 BC was an extraordinary one for visible astronomical occurrences. Nothing like it had happened for centuries. Since this is the very period when most early Christian scholars said that Jesus was to be born, or was in fact born, and also the time remarkably in agreement with New Testament chronological indications, it would be prudent to focus our attention on this period. Some major points of significance will be in store for us when we do. So that ends chapter three of what was the real star.
Yeah, you left it on a real mysterious point there. okay, everybody, you can read this book. It is free to read online at askelm.com. And I am sure that there's many of you out there who are not aware of the information that is presented by Dr. Martin and David Seeloff. This is file number 2, and we have covered chapters 2 and 3 on this file. And it is the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And this particular writing that Dr. Martin did, the information in here has been used by many scholars, if I'm correct, David.
Yeah.
And even observatories changed their planetary schedules.
Their planetarium shows.
Yes, the shows. To what was said in this book, because it is, it's true. And very, very well done, excellent material. So, yeah, David, a question. Do the Rechabites come in here anywhere?
Rechabites?
Yeah.
Not that I recall.
Okay. Yeah, because they were...
Who are they?
They were a very special priesthood that knew an awful lot of things. And there are people that believe that they are that particular organization, as it were, is still around today. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't bet money on it. Anyway, the Star of Bethlehem video created by Griffith Observatory, and you can watch that video at askelm.com. Look on there and go to video, and you will see this Star of Bethlehem presented, and it is really something to see, so go do it and learn about these things. There's deeper things and deeper insights, I think, into some of the manuscripts than what has been in the past conveniently, shall we say, presented by various quote end of quote religious organizations. We want, all of us here, we want the truth, and that's what we're looking for. We are not looking for some guy's religion per se.
And we don't want to be spoon-fed anymore either.
Right, exactly. Well said, Dave. My hands are clapping together. I'm into that. So God bless you, David Seeloff, for the work that you're putting in. And everybody out there, blessings to you too. And go to askelm.com. And if you have questions, email David Seeloff at david@askelm.com. Go to the website, askelm.com. And look for this book. Now, David, you are doing some lecturing in Southern California.
Right.
Do you want to give out that information?
Well, it's dated information. I mean, it'll be over and last next Saturday, but...
Well, who knows? Somebody might hear this and beat feet right down there and... And listen, you've got one coming up on the 15th.
Right. That's a conference that I'm giving a presentation with Professor George Wesley Buchanan.
Right.
He's presenting on the location of the temple that he and Dr. Martin researched independently.
Mm-hmm.
came to the same conclusion. And I'm going to give a talk on the location of the tomb of King David at Grace Chapel in Rosemead, California. You can just type in Grace Chapel, Rosemead. It's just a small group is renting that building on Saturday, the 24th. That's not next Saturday. That's a week from Saturday. November 24th, after Thanksgiving, at Grace Chapel at 2 p.m. on the 24th of November. And so just type in Grace Chapel, Rosemead on Google or Yahoo or any of that, and you'll come up with a map.
And that's California.
Correct. Right. Yeah, a little detail.
Yeah.
It's always good to get their state correct. Yeah.
Yes. And also, if you go to the Byte Show and you go to the library and you click on David Seeloff's name, it's under Pastors and Teachers, his page will open up. And right at the top here, I've got special news from David Seeloff. Well, there is a PDF file that you can click on and read. It has the times and the places. And as David said, there's one on the November 15th and another one on the 24th.
Yeah, and there's a map for the one on the 24th.
Okay.
Also in Rosemead, yeah.
Yeah.
It's easy to get to if you know Los Angeles area.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit.
The hotels in downtown Vegas are easy to get to, too, if you know how to get there. Inside joke. Oh, my gosh. You can see them, you know, they're towering way up in the sky. But from where you are, point A, to figure out the maze of streets to get down there, it's something else. Anyway, good heavens. This ends tonight's visit here with David Seeloff. And God willing, we will be back. So God bless every one of you listening, and learn, pray. Good night, everybody.